Well, greetings again. You might get the impression that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. But we have faith. We're walking on water. Now, I have a couple of other items that I should have mentioned during announcements. Now, this day just started funny. A couple of days ago, Friday, I was driving down the freeway and a large rock hit the windshield, and I've got a crack about this long in the front windshield. And then today, I got up and went for a walk, and it was a little overcast, but very nice. By the time we left, it was raining. I went through a blinding snowstorm over Buckhorn Pass. We ran over a large rock. And, hey, we're here. So everything's okay. It's just one of those days. Now, I have a card here from Mary Dudley. But I'm not going to read it, but it'll be out on the table for you. And I also have a thank you from someone that we sent a card to, a Get Well card to, and telling them that we were praying for them, and that I'll put that on the table as well. And would you look at this? Brand new. Just signed yesterday. It's an honor roll award for Sarah Goodrich. The A honor roll. How about that? So even with all the trials and whatever, there's still good news. Okay, well, I've been thinking about this next message for a while. You know, as we get closer to the Passover, now I've been reminded of how odd our traditions are, the Church of God traditions, to those that are not part of our church community. Now, I remember hearing a funny story when I first came to the church over 40 years ago about something that happened in Big Sandy, Texas. Now, they had the new Ambassador campus down there, and for the first time they were keeping the spring holy days. And wouldn't you know it, they had people going to all the stores, all the markets around there, seeking unleavened matzos. And they didn't have them. And it caused quite a stir. So, of course, the merchants were disappointed because they had all these new customers and they couldn't provide the need. Well, wouldn't you know it, because the demand had been so high, when the fall holidays rolled around, they were heavily stocked with unleavened matzos. And they were shocked because nobody wanted to buy them. Of course, you know, they don't know anything about our culture, and they didn't have a clue what the holy days are about. Now, few outside the church really understand anything about the holy days or their meaning. I want to read a passage here in Exodus 12 that sets the tone for this season, the season that's upon us. Exodus 12, and I'll begin in verse 1. Moses and Aaron, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, "This month shall be the beginning of months, your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year," so it's a very young lamb. "You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasting in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. So that's why this season is called the Passover, not just the Passover itself, but the days including the unleavened bread. Of course, this what I just read is speaking of the very first Passover. Now, that took place just before the Israelites were freed from slavery. Now, it probably would seem pretty strange, or it does seem strange, unless you understand why. You know, it's curious that they would take a lamb on the 10th day of the month and bring it in close to the family. They keep it there 4 days before they kill it. You know, why not just on the 14th day go and get the lamb and kill it? Why not do that? Well, of course, many have suggested that it just wouldn't have the same impact. Now, if you bring this small lamb in close to the family, you're dealing with people who are they're used to living off livestock. So killing a lamb or a goat or a cow or other animals, chickens, whatever, is not a big deal. But if you take that livestock, you take that little lamb and you bring it close to the family and it's there for several days, it starts to feel a little bit like a pet. You feel a little bit more close to this animal. To kill that animal on the 14th day has a much deeper impact on the family. You know, to see its blood shed, putting that blood on the doorpost, it has a completely different impact. Let's continue on in verse 12 of Exodus 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on your houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Now you're talking about a devastating blow to Egypt. Both man and beast, all the firstborn would die unless they were inside that building with the blood on the doorposts. Now I suspect some families were completely wiped out. You know, the firstborn marries a firstborn, has a firstborn child. That family was completely gone. This was a devastating event that was to take place. As I say, this season is referred to as a Passover. You know, it includes the days of unleavened bread. Let's continue in verse 14. So this day shall be to you a memorial. It's a memorial. It's going to be a memorial. And you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats unleavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. In the first month On the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days, no leaven shall be found in your houses. Since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing but leaven. You shall eat nothing leavened. In your dwellings, you shall eat unleavened bread. Pretty specific, pretty clear. But again, if you're not part of the church culture, it seems like a really strange custom. It seems like a strange command. Not to eat leavened bread. But he doesn't tell you just not to eat unleavened bread. You can't even have it in your house. The Israelites were told that anyone who ate unleavened bread would be cut off from Israel. You can, that's a, what do you call that? It's sort of a euphemism for being killed. You do that, you're dead. To be cut off. That's a pretty harsh threat. Now, obviously, God thought this was important. It's also interesting, as I mentioned, that it wasn't just enough not to eat unleavened bread, but you couldn't have leavening anywhere in your homes or on your property. You couldn't have it anywhere. They'd completely get rid of it. I won't ask you to turn there, but in the next chapter, Exodus 13, verse 7, it says, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. You couldn't have it anywhere. Now, of course, for the Church of God, these biblical instructions gave rise to some pretty interesting spring cleanings. Now, we laugh at the humorous things that happened during the days of unleavened bread. In all our efforts to make sure that there wasn't any leavening in our homes or cars or whatever. I'm sure you have lots of stories. No, I do too. Now, I borrowed a car once during the days of unleavened bread. I thought, well, this is a great car. And I love this front seat. It has an armrest. I pulled that armrest down. Guess what? There was a dried out McDonald's hamburger in that car. Hidden in the armrest. It was stunning. I worked in the art department in the early days there at Ambassador College. And a guy came in, he had these little flat crackers. He was passing them around to people and people were scarfing them down. I said, boy, these are good. Somebody decided to read the box. He said, hey guys, this has leavening in it. They were stunned. He felt like such an idiot. And I thought, I'm really going to be smart this year. For lunch, I'm going to buy lunch every day. And I'm going to go to Taco Bell. Easy. And they make these great burritos. Well, those flour tortillas that they're not even an eighth of an inch thick, they have leavening in them. And my wife, she had to ruin it. About halfway through the feast, she told me that they had leavening. And I felt like a complete idiot. And there are so many stories. I love this one. There was a guy that had these Fig Newton cookies. I think he was a student. And the day was coming really quickly. He didn't have time to get rid of them. He couldn't eat them all. So he decided he'd flush them down the toilet. The problem was, he decided to flush all of them down the toilet at the same time. It stopped the toilet up. The water started rising. The crumbs are falling off the edge of the Fig Newtons. It's running out over the floor. It's spreading out all over the place. I'm sure you have a lot of funny stories too. Now, the simple fact is this, that no matter how focused we were, and maybe even a little fanatical about cleaning up 11, we just couldn't get rid of the stuff. You couldn't find it all. Now, how many of you, maybe after, a week or two after the days of unleavened bread, you go to get something out of the freezer and there's a carton of something in there with leavening in it. And it was there the whole time. We just couldn't get rid of the stuff. Now, it was everywhere. And it was certainly in places you wouldn't even consider looking. It would never even cross your mind that you might have leavening there. I had a guy tell me one time, he said, I got some new tires, and I decided I'd take one of the ones off a car that I was replacing. It was better than my spare tire. So I was going to have him put that on that wheel. He said, when I took the tire off that wheel, there was a dried up sandwich inside. So he was driving around all this time. Who would look inside a tire to find leavening? It's just pervasive. Just couldn't get rid of it. Now, something I also find sadly amusing is stories you would read during the days of unleavened bread, how certain Jews would observe the day. Now, like the one where they would take all the leavening, they get all the leavening together, put it in a bag, or a couple of bags, put it in a closet and throw a blanket over it. Then after the days of unleavened bread were over, then to take the blanket off and take it all back and use it. I thought, well, let's say I kept the commandment. Now, as a follow-up, I decided this year, something I haven't done in a long time, but I decided to look up something and look up about the Feast of Unleavened Bread, how the Jews keep it, and I found this interesting story. It's called Feast Without Yeast. Why are some foods kosher and others not? It said, Jews of different backgrounds do not observe all the same rules. I'm sure I'm not going to get this right, but Ashkenazi Jews who come from Europe, Ashkenazi, Jews who come from Europe, most Jews in America, also avoid corn, rice, peanuts, and legumes, as they are also used to make bread and have other grains mixed in. These items are known as kitniot. Kitniot? K-I-T-N-I-Y-O-T. Kitniot. Okay. They say rules and guidelines may be extremely stringent. Not only must Orthodox Jews not eat these items, but they also must completely remove them and any food that has come in contact with them from their homes. They may throw them away, burn them, or how about this line, or sell them to a non-Jew. They are allowed to buy them back at the end of Passover. That's how they get rid of it in Israel, in the nation of Israel. They sell everything to a non-Jew, and then they buy it all back. Anyway, they talk a little bit about the cleaning process and after that. Now, of course, for us, all this seems a bit silly because we know that God is not really concerned all that much about leaven. He's just using leaven as a symbol to help us learn a very important lesson. Leaven is likened to sin in that it puffs people up. People get prideful and get proud. They get puffed up. So that's why they use leaven as a symbol of sin. Let's turn to Corinthians 5, 1 Corinthians 5. First Corinthians 5, verse 6. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Now, if you just have a little bit of pride, that's going to get you. Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I'm going to mark something down at the end of my notes here. Now let's go to Matthew 16. You read a few verses there. Matthew 16, verse 6. Then Jesus said to them, Matthew 16, 6, then Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, is it because we have taken no breath? Is that why he's telling us this? Verse 8, that Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, O you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves, because you have brought no breath? Do you not understand or remember the five loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Nor the seven loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? Some may not be aware of it, but that the loaves and the fishes, that happened twice. It wasn't just once, it was twice that took place. That's what he's referring to there. How is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread, but to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees? Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now they had so many things that they would tell people to do, but they were hypocrites. Hypocrisy. So clearly, ridding ourselves of leaven, only to bring it back after the Passover season is done, that's completely missing the point and the purpose of these holy days. So God expects us to live an unleavened life. We do that by striving to keep the commandments, not by keeping them during the holy days, and as soon as the holy days are over, you go back to sinning. So the symbolism of the Passover and the season should be obvious. Now what happened? Israel was freed from Egypt. Egypt was a type of sin. They left Egypt. They walked away from Egypt. They walked away from sin. They ate unleavened bread. This is all physical stuff, but it's symbolic. When the days of unleavened bread were over, they didn't go back to Egypt. I hope the symbolism is clear. We are to leave sin behind. We are to keep the commandments. We're not to return to sinning after the holy days, but to continue moving forward toward that promised land, salvation. Now this brings us to the need for self-examination as we get closer and closer to the Passover. Just a quick reference here to 1 Corinthians 11. Corinthians 11, verse 28. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat the bread, eat of the bread, and drink of the cup. He's talking about the Passover. For For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. Now, do you think all this effort to clean out the leaven, to clean it, to look for it in the house, to clean out the car, now, is that what all of this stuff about leaven is really about? Is that what's going on? You know, it's amazing to think back on all the times people in the early days in my experience in the church, including myself, you know, we spent so much time searching out the leaven. You know, we were meticulous. Just things that you didn't know what leaven looked like exactly, but you see a little speck in the carpet of the car. It might be leaven. You just get it out of there. Clean it out. Now, taking out those trash bags, making sure we got them off the property. Oh, get the bag out of the vacuum cleaner. That's got leaven in it. Certainly wasn't anything we were going to eat. But we weren't going to have it on our house, in our house anywhere. Now, it seems to me that none of us were ever really quite as meticulous. We just weren't as careful in searching our own hearts for the leaven in our life. It's hard to see deep into your soul in those crevices and places that we generally don't look to very much, and in places that we would never expect to find leaven or sin. Well, the question now is this. You know, how are you preparing yourself for the Passover? Are you just going to give it this quick once over and examining yourself? Are you going to be careful and meticulous and look deeply into areas perhaps that you've never really considered or looked into before? No, don't kid yourself. We all need this deep introspection. Perhaps you've already begun. Now, I'm reminded of a scripture that when I first came to the church, we all knew quite well. We had it just burnt into our brains. But I haven't heard it used in some time. I haven't heard it used in decades, really. Jeremiah 17:9. You old-timers, I know that you know this. Again, like I say, it was just burnt into our brains. Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Do you believe that your heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked? Of course, none of us wants to think that we personally are that way, that our hearts are that way. Yet I think most would agree that it can be difficult to completely be honest with yourself. It's not always easy to do that. Now, one of the ways a personal weakness in this area manifests itself is in how we judge others compared to how we judge ourselves. Now, when we judge others, or when we judge ourselves, we tend to judge ourselves by our intentions. We judge others, we don't have that. We just judge them by their deeds. What did they do? And it's easy to take that approach. You know, who knows somebody else's heart? You don't know what their intentions are. You can assume you know. But when we look at ourselves, of course, there's always extenuating circumstances. Not necessarily justifications, but there are reasons that things happen the reasons you do things. Now, we have some understanding, at least, why we do things. We have some ideas about what our intentions are. Unless we delude ourselves. Now, I'm reminded of a particularly painful story when I was a young man. Can't even remember exactly what the issue was. But I had made a promise to an older man, someone, a fatherly figure, someone I greatly admired. And something happened, and I didn't follow through on my promise. And he called me on it. Of course, I felt terrible. I felt terrible. I had let him down, you know. And in an attempt to put a positive spin on it, not following through, I said, but I intended to do it. But his response, it just is burnt into my brain as something that I heard just yesterday or even this morning. He said to me, the road to hell is paved with the bodies of those who had good intentions. That hurt. That hurt deeply. But I'm so glad that he said it. I'm forever grateful. It was a powerful rebuke, but boy, it was a hard-earned lesson. I really appreciate him saying that. Now, what are your intentions? Do you really understand the intentions of your own heart? You try to be honest. Why do you do the things that you do? Why do you say the things that you say? Now, these days, just before Passover, that's the perfect time to ask these questions. If you use the Holy Spirit that God has given you, you just might see something about yourself that you've not seen before. Now, I once heard someone give this analogy of a curtain, of us, the real us standing behind a curtain. The curtain slowly being raised, and gradually you begin to see what you really are, who you are. Of course, in the analogy, it's God that's raising the curtain slowly. You know why? Because he knows it would just be too painful to just lift the curtain up and really see ourselves. He might want to die. I remember telling, I made a comment in a sermon some years ago. It wasn't an original thought, but somebody suggest this, and it sounded pretty good to me, so I said, you know, if there's one prayer that's always answered. Now ask God to show you your sins. And I had a guy come up to me later. He said, you know, I did that. And I felt so bad I wanted to kill myself. He was sort of joking, but he wasn't. It was so painful. Because he saw what he was really like. Though God's kind, He doesn't want to hurt us. He wants to help us. So he raises that curtain slowly. That analogy reminds me of a novel. How many of you have ever heard or read the story, The Portrait of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde? This is a literary person right here. She's smart. Another one. Three. I got three people. Well, I suppose that many of you would not be familiar with the story. So I went to the infamous Wikipedia and got a synopsis. Now, this story originally appeared in a magazine, and Oscar Wilde later expanded it into a novel, and it was published in 1891. It's very old, classic literature. Been the subject of several movies. Anyway, here's what they said in Wikipedia. The novel tells of a young man named Dorian Gray, the subject of a painting by artist Basil Hallward. Now, Basil Hallward is one of the characters in the story. Basil is impressed by Dorian's appearance and becomes infatuated with him, believing his good looks is responsible for a new mood in his art. Dorian meets Lord Henry Wotton, a friend of Basil's, and becomes enthralled by Lord Henry's worldview. Espousing a new hedonism, Lord Henry suggests the only things worth pursuing in life are beauty and the fulfillment of the senses. Well, that's almost a classic definition of hedonism, isn't it? Seeking pleasure. Realizing that one day his good looks will fade, Dorian whimsically expresses a desire to sell his soul to ensure the portrait Basil has painted would age rather than he. Dorian's wish is fulfilled, plunging him into debauched acts. The portrait serves as a reminder of the effect each act has upon his soul, and with each sin displayed as a disfigurement of his form or through a sign of aging. So years would go by and Dorian still looked like this young, handsome man. But if he could get in to see the portrait, it was awful. He was a monster. God's great compassion, you know, he promises not to put more on us than we're able to bear, than we're able to handle. And I, for one, am thankful for that. Yet we do need to gradually see ourselves for who we are and what's in our hearts. And it's not easy. But it has to happen. I'm going to give an example here of something that happened on the night that Jesus was taken. It's in Matthew 26. Matthew 26. And verse 56. Is that right? Oh, wrong verse. Matthew 26, verse 34. Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you, that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Verse 35, Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all the disciples. You see Peter's good intentions. Let's go back to Luke 22. Luke 22, now to verse 56. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, this is Peter, looked intently at him and said, "This man was also with him." This guy right here was with Jesus. Now, where was Peter? He was in the courtyard there where Jesus was being held. But he denied him, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." And after a little while, another saw him and said, "You also were one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." Then after about an hour, had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, "Surely this fellow was also with him, for he is a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are saying." Immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. Verse 61. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Now the words are coming out of Peter's mouth as he's saying it. The third time he sees Jesus' head turn, he sees his eyes looking right at him, at his eyes. And he remembers what was said. So Peter went out and wept bitterly. I'll bet he did. He had no idea that he would be that weak and that he would deny Jesus Christ. Now toward the end here, I don't mind sharing something with you that at the close that just came to mind a few days ago for me. That's a glimpse of something that's been buried in my heart that I just haven't really focused on before. You know, one of my pet peeves is people driving slowly and they won't pull over to let you pass. And I run into this every single time I drive over here to Eureka. And when I drive back over to Reading, there's always somebody on the road who's driving slow, and it must be a power trip for them. They have turnout lanes, they won't use it. Now I don't turn into this road rage maniac. That's not what happens. I've got pretty good control on it. I just realize this is going to take some time. But every once in a while, it doesn't happen all the time, but every once in a while, I have this little fantasy pop into my brain. I think, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could just... Mm-hmm. You know, their car engine dies, they have to pull over, or to get a flat tire, or the transmission falls out, something. Wouldn't that be great? And then they'll learn to be courteous to other drivers. Well, maybe they'll learn. Maybe they won't. Well, a couple of weeks ago, Ann and I go to the movies about two or three times a month. And a couple of weeks ago, I went by myself. Ann didn't feel like going. So I went alone and I saw this film called Chronicle. Anybody here seen that? One. Okay. Yeah, I thought it's a movie that would appeal more to younger people. Chronicle. It's about this a teenager that decides to start recording everything with his camera. Anyway, I saw this movie. It was really intriguing. There was a story about these three teenage boys that were exposed to some kind of energy, unknown energy source. And within two or three weeks, they started displaying telekinetic power. Now, at first, it was just simple stuff that they were doing and moving. But they kept getting stronger and stronger. You know, like they went into a parking lot, saw this lady come in and park her car. She went into the store. One of them moved her car to another place for this telekinetic power. Then they laughed and laughed, and she came out and she couldn't find her car. The typical stuff that teenagers would think of doing. So they kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And more powerful in their telekinetic ability. Anyway, there was this one scene, they're driving down the road, and what do you know, there's some maniac driving really fast, comes racing up behind them, honking his horn, and it was just the guy in the backseat that made him angry, because he'd been bullied around so much of his life. And finally, he went like this, the front of that car crushed in on itself. The car swerved and went down an embankment. And his friends stopped. They were furious. They thought, "You can't do that. You hurt somebody." Now, what's scary is that that really isn't all that different from my road fantasy. No, I don't want to hurt anybody. But the situations, there's an eerie similarity to that in this fantasy that I'd had. I kept thinking about it, and kept thinking about it, and kept thinking about it. And I was reminded, in thinking about it, why we humans can't have power. You can't have that kind of power. Because we're not strong enough not to abuse it. Now, we're supposed to learn to love our neighbors as ourselves. Is it loving your neighbor to crush the front of his car and send it down an embankment? Well, no. Is it loving your neighbor to make his transmission fall out? Well, no. Or to give him a flat tire? That's not showing perfect love. I have one last scripture here I'm going to give. In Romans 13... Romans 13, verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, all are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now this film helped me to see something that I thought that wasn't right. Something I had to get rid of. And maybe I haven't gotten rid of it completely yet, but I'm certainly going to work on it. I'm looking for a scripture that I gave earlier. And I had written something down, and early in the sermon, this thought had come to mind. I wanted to go back and look at this verse again. Oh, here it is. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6, where it says, your glorying is not good. Well, verse 8 says, therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness. Now this film helped me see a spot on my heart that I had to get rid of, as I said. Now it's going to help me root out something that is wrong before God. That we have to deal with personal issues such as this. And I certainly pray that God is going to help us. You know, when you look into your own heart, you don't expect to find malice or wickedness. But it can jump up and surprise you. There can be things there that maybe you've been carrying around for years. Maybe it's something you've been carrying around for a lifetime. I don't know. I don't know what's in your heart. I'm not sure of everything that's in my own. I pray that God will help each of you to see what you need to see in yourself as we approach the Passover.